Well, I wish I was a catfish swimming in a deep blue sea. I would have all you good looking women fishing after me, showing up after me, showing up after me. Oh, Lord.
Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is my returning guest tonight is writer, producer, and music historian Robert Gordon, and we're talking about his book "Can't Be Satisfied: The Life and Times of Muddy Waters." Robert, welcome back to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you again.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate you having me on each time.
I can't emphasize this enough for the audience, but only certain people can write about music and music history well, and you're one of the few. and that's, especially when you're writing about a figure like Muddy Waters, sense of place, to give the reader a sense of the feel of the time, I think is essential, and you do that so well in this book, so thank you so much for writing it.
Well, good. You know, it helps that this is, it's from the part of the country where I'm from, Memphis, Mississippi, you know, Delta area. So I've been immersed in it, and I feel a closeness to it. And it was fun to go up to Chicago and kind of learn that, because I didn't know that.
Was it difficult to piece together his early years?
Here's the thing about Muddy Waters. Yes, it was very difficult, because there was never going to be, like, a box of Muddy's writing,
right,
you know, with his diary. He couldn't write. He couldn't read, and he couldn't write to speak of. He could make a grocery list, but that was about it. And so going back and finding information became this a real oral history search, and also a work with government documents. And
wow,
you know, it was a lot of pieces to put together. And I would get thrilled when marriage licenses, little things like that. You could glean so much. So I made the most of what I had.
You really did. Now, I love this. His boyhood home still stands, but not in the same place. Explain that.
It's an interesting thing. Yeah, Muddy's boyhood home was originally a cypress cabin built by a hunter on what became Stovall Plantation. Over the years, it became a sharecropper shack. They added on a little space to it, and then Muddy and his family lived there. That's the kind of place where, you know, the boards on the exterior didn't meet up, and so wind would literally blow through, and you'd go inside, and the walls would be covered by whitewashed newspaper. This flowery paste would go over newspaper, and that was the wallpaper to keep the wind out. So he was raised in that kind of poverty, and then in later years, after he was gone, his shack was dismantled piece by piece and given a world tour of its own. It actually went to like a world's fair, and now it's inside the museum in Clarksdale at the Delta Blues Museum.
Well, you visited his home in Chicago, and that seemed like that was definitely on the verge of just falling down too.
And I believe still is. It's been condemned a few times, and then activists save it, and there's like a lot of plans to try to do something with it, but they've got all kinds of problems. It's a really cool place because that home, it's a three-story place. Muddy would rent out, he would rehearse in the basement and rent out rooms. So like tons, you know, Otis Spann, Memphis Slim, all these great, James Cotton, everybody rented a room in the basement from Muddy Waters, who was an entrepreneur always, even from his earliest days, always had side gigs.
Let's get to some basics before we start with his history. And because I'm always acutely aware that a lot of people may not know some basic music history of certain kinds of music.
Right.
And one of the things that I thought that was very prescient that you wrote in the book is that the importance of Muddy Waters is that he was emblematic, but just not only for his music, but for so much more. Talk to me about why Muddy was emblematic of other things other than his music.
You're talking about as a symbol of the Great Migration.
Yeah.
So there was the industry in the North during World War II along, you know, along with the all the people going overseas to fight, and the need to create weaponry and run the factories, created this migration of especially African Americans and poor people from the agricultural South to the industrial North, and that became known as the Great Migration. And it really began at the start of the 1900s, and was fueled the industry fueled it, the wars fueled it. But Muddy went up in 1941 and 42, right there at the time. In 43 he went up north finally.
Yeah.
But the you know, right there in the heart of World War II, he made more. He realized once he started working overtime, he was making more in a week than he had made in a year as a sharecropper in Mississippi.
Let's talk about that, because one of the many vivid pictures you paint in this book is the life of a sharecropper in mm-hmm. rural Mississippi, which was yep. the life of Muddy Waters. His mother, Ollie Morganfield, was his father. His mother was Bertha Grant.
Right.
And the whole family was involved as cotton pickers, as sharecroppers. And it was it doesn't get more basic and more rough a life than to be a sharecropper. But that's not all that Muddy did either. But talk to me about that life that sort of spawned his soul.
You live basically in a two-room shack, and you walk out your back door to your 40 acres or your plot of land. And you don't own it. You get everything from the plantation. The furnish. They furnish you the seed. They furnish you the land. They furnish you the lodging. The sharecroppers just called it the furnish. You know that they're basically that they would be supplied everything. Then they would work, and then at the end of the year, when cotton was harvested, half of it went to the farm, to the plantation owner, and then they began to take expenses out of the other half. So basically, you were guaranteed of living a life in impoverished and in debt. It was you weren't a slave, but you were enslaved by labor.
Now, you write that Muddy was born on a musical cusp, coming of age at the time. The blues were finally crystallizing as a genre. And there's so many words that you write about the blues. Can you just say something about the blues as a genre of music? And that's a big question. I understand.
It is big. I'll go with, like, to me, it's agricultural. It's a very direct form of music, and it's very emotional. So It begins in the country with a slide guitar. I really think has a lot to do with the blues. And there's certain poetic patterns, you know, AAB kind of things. But I think what really defines the blues is the way that it captures someone expressing their feelings and conveys those feelings. And it's not always sad, and that's important. You know, one really good definition of the blues is feeling good about feeling bad.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, it's an escape.
You write about, you mentioned this, that the importance of the bottleneck style and the evolving importance of the guitar, because the guitar was really not forefront in the beginning until the bottleneck really brought it out front.
Right, right. And it's sort of that's, you know, which becomes rock and roll, you know, the guitar-based rock and roll that we had from the latter half of the 20th century. And it all grows out of that Delta Blues experience, I think.
Yeah.
And Muddy, so when this is all crystallizing in the Delta, you know, and being documented by, it's first documented in, I think, 1903 by an archaeologist from afar who's come to excavate some Indian mounds, hires locals, and hears this slide guitar sound coming from their camp at night and goes to investigate.
Where do people go to hear music?
The nearest place, you know. There weren't, you know, not there, there. It wasn't like there was jukeboxes for a long time. There wasn't electricity to have a jukebox.
There was no radio that paid attention to this music either.
No, not till 1948.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that in a bit.
Okay. So basically, like, Muddy realized, hey, I'm a player. People like me. I'm going to have a party. And so he would have he one of his sidelines was turning his house into a juke joint on Friday and Saturday nights. He also, another sideline was he brewed homebrew. He made White Lightning. So he was having the party, selling the whiskey, and providing the entertainment.
One of the things you write about, and it's important for people to, again, to understand this, is that because there was no radio, because there was no sort of communication, that one town versus another could be a whole different musical style and set of artists.
It's kind of like the way you can sometimes hear in people's voice where they're from, in the broadest sense, north or the south, you know. But when in the olden days, especially before there was so much nationalized media, which is when we're talking about with these songs, you know, a city or town had its own identifying characteristics. So someone might sing just any blues standard, you know, John Henry, and you could tell by the inflections in how they did it, or you know, in the verses that they sang, oh, you must know so-and-so, you know.
Yeah. Now, what was some of his early influences, Son House and Big Joe Williams?
Yes, and Robert Johnson, you know, that North Delta area around Clarksdale. Son House was the big man around there. I love Son House's playing. I was interviewed for a film about Robert Johnson and didn't make the cut because all I talked about was how much more I liked Son House. Because Son House plays in this, it's angular, if you will. It's just a lot more hard strikes. It's less poetic, but it's more, it comes from a deeper, darker emotional well, I think. And Muddy was able to, and he's playing, and by the way, Muddy, Son House, Robert Johnson shared a lot of the same songs, a lot of the same, and also you would hear a lot of the same lyrics coming up in different combinations in their own songs, but many of these songs were all shared. So you can hear in Muddy elements of Son House and Robert Johnson. Big Joe Williams was a big itinerant blues man who sort of picked up and dispensed styles as he went.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight, always a pleasure to have him on, is writer, producer, and music historian Robert Gordon. And we're talking about his book, Can't Be Satisfied, The Life and Times of Muddy Waters. There's a great moment where this person, this white guy, Alan Lomax, is looking for Muddy, and he can't figure out what this guy is wanting.
Muddy can't, yeah.
So talk to me about that whole thing about Alan Lomax and Fisk University and the Library of Congress.
Lomax shows up, you know, kind of unannounced because he's asked around, as he's going around the Delta, he's asked around, you know, who are the good players? And people have led him to, you know, go to Stovall's plantation, ask for Muddy Waters. So when word gets to Muddy, because of course word's going to get to Muddy before the white guy will, you know, there's a known, you know, if a white guy's looking for you, it's probably not good. And Muddy thought it was actually the revenuer, you know, just like the great old cartoons. He thought he was going to be busted for having a still. So he was hiding from this guy until he couldn't hide from him anymore. And Muddy was barefoot, actually, when they met. Lomax recalled, and the thing that won Muddy over to Lomax was Lomax is asking him all about his music, and that's not working because Muddy thinks it's the, you know, he's being tricked and he's going to get busted. But when Lomax asks for a drink of water and then drinks out of the same cup that Muddy drinks out of, a white man sharing a black man's cup, he says, no revenue agent would do that. This man must be telling the truth.
And what was the project that Alan Lomax
John Work.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was this idea to do field recordings and capture an expression of a place. And John Work was an African-American musicologist at Fisk, and he enlisted Alan Lomax at the Library of Congress, and they went out and were just doing, they were doing field recordings, and it was so rich in 41 that they developed it into a curriculum at Fisk, and they and they did sociological studies with grad students administering questionnaires over the coming year, and they came back down in 42 and recorded more. In fact, just side note, I got really involved in the correspondence and everything that was found there, and there's a side book called Lost Delta Found. It's actually being honored this year as a into the Blues Music Hall of Fame or something. But it really focuses on the work that the African-American people did on that study and is a compliment to the Lomax book called The Land Where the Blues Began.
It's, you know, they're not recording like we record now on tape.
Or
They're recording, I think you mentioned they were glass discs that were covered with, what, wax or something?
Lacquer or something, yeah. And portable recording meant that, you know, that the unit weighed several hundred pounds. but that it could fit into the back of Lomax's car, and the car was modified, and the unit was modified to run, I get my, you know, I'm not electronics here, AC, DC, it ran off car power.
Wow.
So that made it portable. You could lift it into the trunk of the car, and they could go places to record. And interestingly, the really, what Muddy called, what Muddy recalled as the thing that affected him the most was hearing it played back. You know, the idea of hearing his voice come off a record player, just like by then in the early 40s, there were jukeboxes, Seaburgs, coming around. And so Muddy, they were accustomed to these at the local, at the commissary on the plantation. So when he heard himself like that and sounded like a professional, I think the idea of really leaving the South and leaving that world and trying to make a record in the Great North became a reality to him.
He also was interviewed by Lomax, and there's these, and you excerpt some of these in the book, and it's great to hear him talk. I mean, it was, now he records what I think was noted as Country Blues or I Feel Like Going Home, and that was his first record. Was he paid?
He was promised $20, and a lot of the initial correspondence from Muddy to Lomax. And you can see where he's probably hired. I think he'd probably hired out the writing of these to someone else on the farm who could write, which is still very crude and rudimentarily expressed. But, you know, he's writing to ask for the pay because $20 means so much to him.
Oh, yeah.
But yes, ultimately he was paid, and, you know, there's a photograph of Muddy. It's like at a time when people couldn't afford photographs, and when they did, it was when they got married. You know, them and their wife kind of went to a special place and paid money and got a photo made. Muddy was into his second marriage when he finally got this photo made, and it wasn't him and his wives. It was him and his Library of Congress 78.
Now, a lot of stuff starts to happen. There's a radio station, KFFA, in Helena, Arkansas.
Right.
And so finally, stuff like Muddy's music is being broadcast.
Yes. In 48, this station goes on the air that that basically acknowledges the vast majority of the population who's been in hearing range all this time. Sonny Boy Williamson is the disc jockey.
Wow.
And during the lunch hour, during the lunch 15 minutes, all the field hands could take a break and listen to KFFA. It broadcasts, Helena, Arkansas is on the edge of the Delta, and so this could easily reach into the Clarksdale area.
Wow.
And and so these guys, it was the great validation for the citizens there, for the African American and the poor, because suddenly they heard themselves. In the same way that Muddy heard himself played back, these guys heard their culture played back, and I think it's where they took a lot of strength from.
Now let's talk about the migration to Chicago, the Great Northern Drive. It's amazing to read your story of both Muddy and other musicians and other people migrating to Chicago. They were unprepared for how big Chicago was, and sometimes they would just show up and ask a bellhop or something, do you know this person I know, and can I find him? I mean, what an amazing leap of faith it was to just head up north.
Yes, yes, and how easily scammed so many of those people right. were, you know, which are, there's lots of stories like that. But Muddy did, he had an address, you know, when he arrives, he takes the train up, which I think has a certain victory in it too, you know. And he has an address, and he gets to that address. It's where, you know, I know he couldn't read that address, and certainly the names didn't mean anything to him, but it's where some people from Stovall had established an apartment, and I'm sure it was a crash pad, you know, that people from Stovall would be falling there all the time until they could get on their feet, and then they'd move on. And each person who came opened their doors up to others behind them. It's sort of how this great migration worked, ever expanding.
Now, it's a difficult time for blues musicians in Chicago, because at that time, Chicago is a jazz town.
Yeah. It's a jazz town. There's also going to be a musicians' strike where they can't they can't do any recording, and so Muddy. But there's this subculture, you know, that Muddy falls into. I mean, just imagine if whatever city you're in, you know, this migration of a whole other culture is constantly going on beneath the radar, and so it's like. You know, Muddy sort of gets into this underworld. He's getting paid working at a factory, but at night there's this huge population of people who may have been living in Chicago now for years, but they know where they're from. They're from Helena. They're from, right. you know, Enterprise. They're from any of these small Delta towns. And Muddy gets in with them, and so you're comfortable. You share the same background. You can talk about family and in a way that you can't with these people up north. And that ultimately is going to grow from, you know, people's apartments and houses to bars. And slowly but surely, Muddy's going to find his way into those bars.
Now, a lot of people who don't know musical history find it hard to believe that we're in the 40s, but this is the coming of the electric guitar. Does Muddy adopt the electric guitar?
Muddy is always on the cutting edge, I got to say. It really surprised me. You know, he bought a car as soon as he could. He saw technology. He embraced technological advantage. I'm sure he would have, like B.B. King, he would have had an iPhone early on, you know. but Muddy got an electric guitar and got comfortable with it. You know, it was different. Playing it, he talked about how the notes sustained for so much longer and the mistakes were more easily amplified. It called for more precision, but it also allowed the slide
yeah.
extra elegance, I think, because of that sustain. And he was able to translate his Southern thing onto this new instrument. And in fact, the first song, the way he makes it, he's called into these sessions in Chicago as a backing player. And it's always the sweet stuff, like the, you know, when you say jazz, it's not even like the edgy jazz. They're recording this really saccharine kind of hokum stuff, and finally at the end of one session, Muddy goes, "Let me record one my way." You know, it's not just don't put me in the front and let me do your saccharine stuff. I want to play, and he does the same two songs he recorded for Lomax and Work. What comes up to be called Can't Be Satisfied and Feel Like Going Home. Feel Like Going Home is actually Lomax mishearing the words Feel Like Blowing My Horn,
right.
a sexual innuendo. But he records those same two songs, puts that sort of Chicago electricity and, you know, in both senses, the power is there, the juice is there, and so is the energy from the street. And these songs become, you know, the beginning of modern city electric blues.
Now, we're almost out of time, but the big moment is Muddy meets the Chess Brothers, Leonard and Phil, and starts recording for what, Aristocrat?
First for Aristocrat, and then that becomes Chess.
And it's 1305, I think, Muddy Waters with an accompaniment. and it's his first ride. And that that exposes Muddy to the world.
Yes, he actually says one night as he's coming home, having these songs are just out, and again, it's that radio affirmation. People hear it coming out of stores, and this culture that of people in the North from the South hear their voice, their new voice. And it sells out real quick, and they keep making more. Muddy says one night he heard it. He was driving home, and he heard it coming from an upstairs apartment, and he pulled it over because he thought he might have died.
He records in 2.5 years with Aristocrat. He records 35 sides, 25 of them as band leader. That's an incredible output.
Yeah, well, you got talent, man. You know, what's the no complaint there? More Muddy Waters, I'm for it.
We're completely out of time, but there's a great moment when he travels to England, and he's sort of surprised people know who he is.
Yes. Well, there's all sorts of mishaps in England and embraces, but it is the people over there who come back here, like the Stones, in a press conference, and say, you know, what do you, you know, the reporters in the 60s say, what do you want to do when you're here? And they say, we want to hear Alan Wolfe and Muddy Waters. You know, and they say, where's that? The American reporters have never heard of this talent that Europeans are coming to seek.
This is only the beginning of the story that's recounted in this book. And so you're going to have to buy this book to read the rest of the story. We've just teed it up for you. My returning guest tonight is writer, producer, and music historian Robert Gordon. And we've been talking about his book. Boy, I just want to say again, you want a sense of the time, the place, and the music, you got to read this book. Can't Be Satisfied, The Life and Times of Muddy Waters. Robert, it's always a pleasure talking to you.
Mark, thanks, man. I enjoyed the banner very much.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.
Child, don't you wanna go? Woman, I'm trouble. I be all good now.